Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Yesterday, a whopping 14 states held the Democratic primary, and the former Vice President Joe Biden did well, winning at least 8 states. There's still some counting as we went on the air. His showing led Mike Bloomberg to drop out of the race this morning. The AP reports that Biden, quote, enjoyed an advantage among women and college graduates, a fact that dovetails nicely with our next installment of our series, Recognizing Women's Role in Maintaining Democracy. We call it Keep It 100.
Hey, you gotta keep it 100.
We've been celebrating the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage this year, and while 1920 is the year most associated with suffrage, our next guest is taking us back another 75 years in history to the beginnings of the movement. It's incredible to think that it took almost as long to secure women's right to vote as it's been since the 19th Amendment was ratified in August 1920 after a protracted battle in Congress. Professor Emeritus at UCLA, Ellen Carroll Du Bois, is the author of several books on the history of women's suffrage in the U.S., and her newest book is titled Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. The book is full of stories about the work of activists, both famous and unknown. And Du Bois explains how the women's suffrage movement became divided between those who supported Black rights and those who rejected solidarity, and the division between Black and white women within the suffrage movement itself. I began by asking Professor Du Bois what narratives about suffrage she's hoping to upend with her new book.
Well, I certainly, first and foremost, want people to understand that votes for women was not something that was a single issue movement, that women, that its advocates only advocated for, thinking that getting the right to vote was what their goal was. Their goal was to get the right to vote so that they could achieve other political goals. And all of these suffragists over the 75 years had other visions, larger visions for social change, ranging from the abolition of slavery to temperance, because they believed that alcohol was a particular scourge for women and children, to peace, to labor rights, to, at the end, birth control. These were all goals that women sought once they had the greater power of the vote. And it's why I think it's important, and you ask what I want to upend, I want to make it clear that this struggle is part and parcel of our struggle to use our votes to maintain and extend democracy as women.
That's interesting you should say that. My next question was, you wrote, you see the history of women's suffrage as evidence of the fragility of democracy. How so?
Well, when I started to write this book, I've been working, as you said, on this issue since I was a babe in arms for a half century. But I started to write this book, I guess it would be 5 years ago. I knew that, you know, we'd have a centennial and everything would be celebrated and somebody was going to write a book that covered everything and they were going to use my books to do it. So I thought it might as well be me. But I thought celebrating having the vote would coincide with a woman president. Instead, it has coincided with, I don't think this is too controversial, one of the greatest, an era that in which we are witnessing a tremendous threat to political democracy, perhaps the greatest since the Civil War, in which one after another of our constitutional protections seem to be falling aside, and in which there is a concerted effort to restrain and undermine and restrict the right to vote, especially when it can hurt the man in the top office. We call that voter suppression. I think we can see voter suppression, especially when we realize how many women are crucial to it, the great Stacey Abrams, the upsurge of women voters in 2018, that voter suppression is of a piece with women's suffrage. I mean, we can think that keeping women, fighting against suffragists, political leaders fighting against suffragists for three quarters of a century is voter suppression.
I don't know if you knew this or not. Our other series this year is Protect the Vote, about voter suppression. You've just created the intersection for us.
Well, right. So you win the vote, and then, and this is what I think the coincidence of the centennial and the current state of American political affairs reminds us, something that would not surprise these suffragists, which is political rights are never secured beyond attack, that winning them and defending them are of a piece.
My guest is Ellen Carroll Du Bois. The name of her book is Suffrage: Women's Long Battle for the Vote. So you take us on a history tour. We start with Seneca Falls, the convention that happened there in 1848. I didn't realize this was a last-minute convention. Why was it last minute, and who was expected to attend?
Well, the people who attended were local people. Maybe they came from as far as 15 miles in their wagons. Adding that detail reminds us how long ago it was. The women who championed this, who led this movement, their parents had fought for the Revolution. The Revolution was fresh in their minds. When they took the Declaration of Independence and rewrote it as the Declaration of Sentiments and changed all men to all men and women, the Declaration of Independence was very fresh to them. In fact, and actually, I discovered in writing this book, the word convention was new. It was just beginning to be used for public meetings of political significance. The Women's Rights Convention was held on July 16th. Who attended were, we now know by looking at the list, were disproportionately Quakers. That probably had to do with the fact that the headliner was the most famous Quaker woman in the United States, Lucretia Mott. And also because Western New York was the home of a kind of radical wing of the Quaker movement. And those were the people who came. The leadership was Lucretia Mott and a 33-year-old mother and wife who lived in Seneca Falls. That's why it was in Seneca Falls. Her name became much more famous later, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She was the wife. She was the relative, both the wife and the cousin of major abolitionists. And it was her, I insist, it was her who had this vision of taking the first convention to address women's rights and moving it into the political realm by insisting that women's rights must include political rights.
Once the Civil War comes around, what happens to the suffrage movement?
The result of the Civil War, besides the near destruction of the nation and then its reunification and the destruction of slavery, was arguably the rewriting of the U.S. Constitution. There were three constitutional amendments. The first abolished slavery. And so that's the 13th Amendment. The first 10 amendments are the Bill of Rights. They happen at the same time as the Constitution. The next two amendments are technical. So finally we get to an effort to change the Constitution in a way that affects the social character of the country. And it was suffragists, including Stanton and Anthony and Lucy Stone, who formed the first popular movement for constitutional change. They collected over 100,000 signatures arguing for the 13th Amendment to abolish slavery. And arguably, that was what did it. Then comes the 14th and the 15th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, importantly, establishes national citizenship and does it in a way that doesn't exclude women. It says all persons born in the United States are citizens. It was the 15th Amendment that blew open the alliance between black freedom and women's rights.
How so?
The Republican Party, which was in control, knew that in reconstructing the southern states, if it was going to have a chance to hold on to power, it would have to enfranchise the former slave population, or to be specific, former slave men. So that there was a partisan advantage there that never in the whole history of women's suffrage ever obtained to enfranchising women. No party could count on women's votes. So the Republican Party pushes forward the 15th Amendment, which says that no state can disfranchise on the grounds of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And suffragists who had worked so hard for all of these goals, at least one wing of them, were enraged, and they wanted that amendment to read no disfranchisement on the grounds of race, color, previous condition, and sex, which is what they call gender. And so when it came to the 15th Amendment, they came out against it because, as Stanton said, once this is done, the constitutional door will slam shut. And it did.
My guest is Ellen Carol Du Bois. The name of her book is Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. I want to ask you about a few names. You said names that people, I think, learn or know. I want to ask you about a couple of names of people we don't know and what their contribution were. Frances Ellen Watkins Harper.
Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. She was an African-American woman born free in a slave state, Maryland. She was a writer and a poet. And she was one of the earliest of what was a growing number of African-American women to come out in favor of woman suffrage. She did so at meetings, conventions in 1866 and 67 and 69. But when the conflict between woman suffrage and black suffrage exploded, she took the side that said, well, I have to take the side of my race. And so she went on to continue to fight for the vote did so, I think this is interesting, in the context of an organization that we don't usually think of as being very important for suffrage, and this was the Women's Christian Temperance Union. The Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was, by radical suffrage standards, quite moderate, actually in the 1880s let in more black women, albeit in segregated what were called unions. But this is where a whole generation of women right after the abolition of slavery learned some of the basic political tools.
You write about this split. The split hobbled the suffrage movement for the next three decades, the split between the suffragists and the abolitionists. How so?
Well, I would say in some ways it hobbled the movement for the rest of its life. The split maybe that you're mentioning is it split the suffrage movement in two, and it remained that way until 1890 when it reunified. So now we're at the end of Reconstruction. Now we're into Jim Crow. We're into lynching. We're into disfranchisement, de facto disfranchisement of Southern black men. And the suffrage, the mainstream suffrage movement stays with the character of the society and becomes basically an all-white movement. And that's the case all the way through till 1920. Now, it must be said that attitudes towards racial inequality varied. Susan B. Anthony, for instance, was always a champion of black rights. And the number of black suffragists grows significantly, especially starting in about 1890.
What was the first Supreme Court case to take on women's suffrage?
So I mentioned the 14th Amendment, and the 14th Amendment begins this way. All persons born in the United States are citizens thereof, and then goes on to talk about rights and privileges. And the 14th Amendment has become the basis of the expansion of human rights in American society in many different ways. The suffragists, so now where it's like 1872, the Constitution door slams shut. And suffragists come up with an idea, really quite brilliant idea. They say, well, look, all persons, we're persons, born in the United States or naturalized, that's us, are citizens of the United States, that's us. And so we have, as the rest of the amendment says, rights and privileges. So hundreds of women all over the country went to their polling places and gave this argument to, you know, poor schlubs who had been, you know, paid a dollar to sit at the voting station. And some of them, and the expectation was they wouldn't be allowed to vote, and then they would sue, and then the Supreme Court would get a chance to rule on their interpretation. Mm. And then the Supreme Court would say, yes, they were right. Actually, Susan B. Anthony was one of those whose ballot was accepted. She couldn't believe it. And for that reason and many others, it was not her case that went up. It was the case of a Missouri woman named Virginia Minor. And that case arrives at the Supreme Court in 1874. And in 1875, just as the Supreme Court is beginning to figure out ways to take the guts out of the 15th Amendment, they rule women are persons, therefore women are national citizens, but no, the right to vote is not a right of national citizenship. And this was consequential, not just for the women's suffrage movement, which from then on had to pursue the language that we know of as the 19th Amendment, but for all of us, because it left the right to vote not as a right of national citizenship, but under the control of the states. And there it remains to this day.
Which brings me to the question, what parts of the United States at this point were more open to the idea of women voting?
Well, once we get to this era in which suffragists closed out from the U.S. Constitution, move into the state level, their great successes are in the West. The first state in which male voters vote to change their state constitution is Colorado. It's 1893. When a state changed its constitution, the women of that state gained the right to vote not just for state offices, but all the way up to the president. This means that the women of Colorado voted for president starting in 1896. The biggest Western campaign was California in 1911. I know you're going to say, why the West? Mm-hmm. The old argument was that, you know, pioneer women, they were necessary for their communities. I think more likely it's that the political parties, the established parties, Democratic and Republican, were weaker. So in these are also the years that third parties start surfacing, and they do particularly in the West, particularly the People's Party, the Populist Party. Finally, in 1917, this strategy of state victories crosses the Mississippi and arrives in where we are now, and New York State amends its constitution. And that's really the more than the beginning of the end. It's almost the end of the end.
1917. The year the White House was picketed.
Yes. So at that point, the campaign ramps up. There are two wings, as there always are, radicals and moderates. The moderates engage. I always want to give them a shout out because they are brilliant lobbyists. But the radicals start protesting, and they're the first campaign. They're the first political movement to picket the White House. They picket it every day for months. And finally, after the United States goes to war, then they don't just picket. Then they're arrested and they go to jail. And they're following the lead of their British counterparts in being incarcerated.
My guest is Ellen Carroll Du Bois. We're talking about her book, Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. What was it that allowed the 19th Amendment to happen? Was there a moment? Was this just the culmination of all of what we've been discussing? Was there some specific catalyst that's like, yes, now is the time?
I'd say there are many moments. I think the New York victory was an important moment. It was mm-hmm. the largest congressional delegation, and from that point on, all the New York representatives supported women suffrage. It was the 1918 midterms, which took power away from the Democrats and gave it to the Republicans. And at that point, the two parties begin to fight to gain the right to claim that they were the ones that enfranchised women. At that point, they're starting to to see what the end game is. And then if we go to, because we know, looking at the ERA, that important amendments get through Congress and do not get through ratification. It's a very high bar. I emphasize in the book how touch and go the ratification campaign was. I will leave the details to the readers so they have something to look forward to. Just to say, it ended in Tennessee.
I want to ask you about a couple of things in the book that were just interesting facts and things I just want to know more about that maybe don't necessarily have to do with our subject, but were interesting.
I hope I can answer them.
Bloomers. Can you tell our listeners who Bloomers, the undergarments, are actually named after?
All right. So we're back in Seneca Falls in about 1848, and that's where Elizabeth Stanton lives. And there's a woman named Amelia Bloomer, and she publishes a women's, not quite yet a women's rights newspaper called The Lily. And at that point, this is a very radical period in American history, one of the campaigns around women's rights had to do with the clothes they wore, which we can appreciate, and that they not only wore skirts and corsets and crinolines, but they had tremendous amounts of there was a great belief that actually mm-hmm. it was bad for women's health, that all of this weight on their nether parts was not good for them. And so they started a campaign to wear what were called the Turkish costume, which were a Middle Eastern costume of pants and a kind of short dress on top of them. And this actually got very popular. And after a while, this came down to the name of the woman who had first promoted it. I can't tell you the exact details of how it went from wearing pants to wearing underpants, but it did.
So my last question, because we're running out of time, is two sisters in New York, Susan Smith McKinney and Sarah J. Garnett. Since we're in New York, tell me about these two women and their contribution.
Okay, I'm going to try and remember the details. These are African Americans. They live in Brooklyn. Susan Sleeper Smith, becomes a doctor. Her older sister is, I believe, was an educator. They form a African-American suffrage organization in Brooklyn, and they push hard because the Republican Party had some power in the state, and black men could vote in New York. They weren't mm-hmm. being stopped. And so they work to organize a New York black woman suffrage movement. I found out about them from the work of other historians, but they are among, I just was reading on my Facebook today that my home city of Baltimore, they've discovered two important black suffragists, and they are going to be among the first who will be honored by the state. Let me just say this. The record that we're used to using was compiled by white suffragists, and it does not do justice to the increasing vigor of black woman suffrage activities. And now we're learning about that.
There's so much to learn in this book. It is called Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. Ellen Carol Du Bois, I could talk to you for another hour. Thank you so much for coming.
Come back anytime.
All right, Allison. We'll have you back.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks a lot.